Paul wrote to the Corinthians. He said, the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit. They are foolishness unto him. Neither can he know them. For they're spiritually discerned. The natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit. They're foolishness unto him. Neither can he know them. For they're spiritually discerned. That means God's radar beam ricochets off without effect. There's no receiving equipment. That's why Jesus indicated in the parable that he said, unless you understand it, the parable of the sower, you can't even be his disciple, which means you can't even begin the learning process of learning about him. And John said, this is life eternal. If you want it, this is it. This is life eternal. That a man may know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom he hath sent. Now, there's a vast world out there that sees all that as nonsense. They might as well live in an impenetrable bubble. The things of God couldn't get to them because they don't have the receiving equipment. In fact, a TV evangelist, I remember years ago, before a half a dozen people had a satellite dish. Was bragging that he was going around the world because he had an hour on a satellite, one of the newer satellites, where nobody could watch. It'd be like building a radio station and putting up the tower in a primitive village area where nobody had a radio. And raising offerings because you're ministering daily to those people who can't hear you. They don't have radios. But I'm beaming it out. Maybe the flies will pick it up. Layers that cannot be penetrated because the equipment's not there. Let me say it again, third time now. The natural man, that's what all of this is. You, encased in this house of clay, developing your values from the world around you and your own desires, what I want, what I ought, and what I will, chooses from among these with the pressure from the inner desires of man and the world around us trying to shape us in their image. That's the natural man. This is the cosmos, the natural world around us, the frame of reference. And the natural man receiveth not the things of God, neither can he know them, for they're spiritually discerned. Now, when God created Adam, he put something different on the face of this earth. I have no trouble with evolution. First and foremost, as I've taught many times, there's a vast gulf of time, unknown in its limit, between Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and Genesis 1:2, the earth became a waste and desolation. And At some point, the Spirit hovering over the face of the deep, this waste and desolation, God began a recreative process. How long it took, we don't know. A day with the Lord is 1,000 years. Wouldn't bother if He had evolution going before the cataclysm struck and the earth became a waste and desolation, or whether He started it afterwards. But at some point, He said, let us make, not man, as the King James says. I've said this to you hundreds of times. The Hebrew word for man or mankind is ishi. God said, let us, Elohim, plural. You philosophers and theologians who try to shape God in your image and have simply declared monotheism, one God, and the Trinitarian doctrine, which is logical nonsense. I embrace it. I help write and rewrite the creed of a major denomination. I know what the Nicene Creed declared to be God's nature in the fights of that generation, 4th century. I know what subsequent councils did to philosophize and define God. When Paul said, we see through a glass darkly, we can't really know God. I've said this to you before. The great neo-orthodox theologian whose specific focus was on ontology, a branch of metaphysics, the theory of reality, and ontology, the theory of being, Paul Tillich concluded, it's as blasphemous to define God, which brings Him down and limits Him to our vehicles of communication, as it is to deny Him. We don't know what God's like. But we know in the revelation of His Word the difference between El and Elohim. Elohim's plural. In the beginning, gods. And the Trinitarian doctrine was an attempt to cope with the preferred state of theological thought. One God, not many. Well, there's one supreme. But He has some helpers around. The Jews solved the problem by angels and demons. And for most of the 1st century, Jesus was viewed as top angel. Then they began to worry with the creeds. But whatever you want to do with that, you've got all that philosophizing thrown in free. Humbly we stand before the Word, not knowing what the nature of the Godhead really is, but plural. And even the Trinitarians, with all of their logical nonsense and poetry and faith, that I can do. I've never been non-orthodox, and even my enemies do not criticize my teaching. I just simply say, it's an article of faith. You embrace it, you don't understand it. Anybody that says they understand the Trinity is a mental midget and knows nothing about logic, just as you can't understand the Incarnation, because logic says A cannot be A and not A at the same time, yet faith declares Jesus was A and not A. Man and not man. Same time, all the time, every way. Not man here and God there. Man, God, all the time. Logical nonsense. We don't understand it. God's ability to do what Aristotle says, the Greek philosopher says, you can't do. Well, God created. Aristotle thought. There's a difference. I don't understand it, but wonderful miracle, God's said, not let me, let us make, not ishi man, Adam. The Hebrew word is Adam, from which we get the cognate, Adam. Let us make Adam in our image. Informed something out of the dust of the earth. Didn't evolve on the spot. He formed something out of the dust of the earth. And he breathed into it. Ruach, it's a Hebrew word. And something that was of God Himself went into this creation. And Adam, not man, Adam became a living soul. And God put him in a garden. Put him there to slave the ground, as I'll say later, and said last Sunday. And in the second chapter of Genesis, before he got to Adam, the garden is described as good, but there was no one to slave the garden, to tend it for God. And it was named Eden. The word Eden means heart of God. They're very close to God. God and man communed there, or God and Adam, every day. If Adam needed to know God's will, God was there to tell him every day. God would not, though he made Adam in his image, relinquish power. Now, I know it became the fad 20, 30 years ago to define God as love. God is love. And therefore, God could not be other than loving. And I remember Oral Roberts once saying, God never hurts anybody. And I was close enough to him at that time to say, Oral, what about, tell that to Korah. God opened up the earth and swallowed him up. Tell that to Miriam, on whom God put leprosy. Tell that to Satan, whom God will fry. God is loving. Love is one of his qualities. But what makes him God? How many thousand times have I said this? What makes him God? Power. What makes him a loving God? Right use of that power. But power keeps him God. If he weren't all-powerful, he wouldn't be God. About the same time, a few years ago, a fad went across the land, and the catchphrase caught fire, God's dead. One of the few things I used to, I guess if Christians can pal around with Lester Sumrall in the early days, he wanted me and him to work together, ministers, institutes, and I liked Lester. Lester's a good man, but we canceled each other out too much to work together. I would go to his church in South Bend, Indiana, and help him in the days when he came back from his wonderful work overseas, the greatest work ever done in the Philippines. And he says, they say I'm too old, Lester said to me, when he started the church over again in South Bend at over 60. But one thing Lester said in those days that stuck with me, he said, if God's dead, I want to know who killed him. Because that's the new God on the block. That's the toughest God of them all. And I want to get on good terms with him. Power keeps God where he is. You know who would be God if God weren't all powerful? The devil. Now, wouldn't that be a God for you? He's not God, because God's the boss. And the only reason for the tree in the garden, as I've said, and it seems like all I'm doing is reviewing today, the only reason for the tree in the garden was God establishing the point right off, I made you in my image, I've turned all this part of creation, namely the earth, over to you. You name the animals, which in those days meant power over them and control. You till the garden, which means my heart and synonym. But so you understand who the boss is, and I have a right to say no, here's this tree. Now, I've said over and over again it could have been a watermelon vine. It wasn't the tree of life. They had access to that. It could have been a watermelon wine. It could have been wine, too. Thank God he didn't put the prohibition on that. Could have been a fruit tree of any kind. We hear the non-knowers of the Bible talk about the apple tree. I don't know where that came from. Jesus, God, and all the apostles, nobody ever says an apple tree. Just, it was a no-no tree. Hanging on the branches were little fruits shaped like the word no in whatever language they spoke in the garden. There had never been a tree as attractive as a no-no tree. Now, I could preach for an hour and a half visually describing the no-nos of today. That's what I thought your response would be. It's a no-no tree. So God established, you got everything else. I've made you in my image. I'm going to develop you. And he said something strange after creating Adam's companion, Eve. He said, replenish the earth. To those that think Genesis 1, 2 onward is a beginning creation, replenish means put life where it has disappeared. Now I want you to replenish it. Because there was life on earth before the devastation and before the cataclysm. And Genesis 1, 2 onward, as I've said, is a recreative period. And he says to them, replenish the earth. Well, at least we've accomplished this. We know sex was not a sin before he fell. I think that's the way you replenish. And they hadn't fallen yet. And if you think I'm just being the usual Gene Scott, there are some theologians that have pinned on the original sex act the name original sin. When you can't do it, why not prohibit everybody else? This is, none of this is planned. I have a message if God will let me preach it. Replenish the earth. Stay away from the no-no tree. Because God's a boss. And that established the fact that he was a boss. I've told you, as parents, you better early on with your child have a spot in your house. Long before the child's 6 years old, when half the habit patterns of a lifetime are already established, you better have a spot in your house that your kids don't step on or enter. And there's only one reason you should give. Why can't I go there? Because I said you don't go there. That's all the reason you need. If more parents establish that, we'd have fewer rebels today than if God wanted them by chance. They'd already have learned that there's somebody higher than them with the right to say no. That's what the tree was there for. Because God, in the image that he put in man, gave him freedom. Freedom to affect the direction of his life. Not complete freedom, but the freedom to choose a master. And that's all the freedom you got. You choose a master. There's no such thing as freedom in a vacuum. You are simply free to choose a master. Most of us spend a life thinking we're free, having been manipulated and taken over and mastered by enemies disguised as friends, namely the flesh, the world, and the devil, Satan and his cohorts. When Satan got Eve and Adam to violate God's trust as the stewards of his garden and invade the forbidden territory that the householder had said, don't touch, and thus stewardship was as much avoiding what you shouldn't do as doing what they should do, God said, you touch that tree, you die. Satan said, no, you won't. They've been dying ever since. God said, touch that tree, you die. Satan says, he's worried that you'll be like him. Because you eat that tree, you'll be like him. And what in essence have I said about God? What did I tell you is the one criteria that makes God God. The boss, right? And the power to enforce it. And Satan convinced them they'd be like God, which is, in essence, you can do what you want. There's only one person in the universe that can do what he wants. God. Even Jesus humbled himself and became obedient. And in his obedient incarnation, he said, my will, I've given up on my message, I'm just letting it go now. My will, my meat, rather, is to do the will of my Father who sent me. The only person that can do whatever he wants, including being bad. If he wants to be bad, he can be. I would consider it a sort of leaning toward the bad thought when God said to Moses, get your ass out of the way and let me kill that bunch of bleepity bleep 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 bleepity bleep bleeps and I'll start over with you. Oh, the King James doctored it up a little. But leave the bleepity bleeps out. And just Christian-like say, Brother Moses, would you step sideways just a little? And what do you say? I'm going to burn their... Or, thank you, Moses. Now, I'm going to... How do you say this gently? Kill every last one of them. Morte, dead. And I'll start a whole new family to do with you and what you produce, what this miserable bunch of dead ones do. Well, that's kind of leaning toward the bad. I mean, he had promised Moses, or rather Abraham, that he would bring him out back to Canaan, richer than when they left, and they weren't back to Canaan, and they weren't, well, yeah, they were richer when they left, but wouldn't buy much for them dead. They weren't back in the promised land. Well, but God, he can figure out how to get around that. You think you're good at figuring out how to get around things? As long as Moses, who was a descendant of Abraham, was around, and God reaches over here in some heathen nation and plucks himself a nice, fair young lady, and they start over again, the genes of Moses or the genes of Abraham, and take a little more time, but I can still get my job done, wipe this miserable bunch of bleepity bleeps out. God's the only one who can do that. Who wouldn't want to be like God? I've convinced myself it's wonderful to be godly. I'd like to be like God. I don't even want to ask Moses to step aside. I'll just knock his ass down and I got a whole line of people I would have wiped out before the Bulls finished their game today. I mean, there are a couple of women that head the list. And I know a couple. Man, I'd feed what they think is so precious to the dogs. I want you to know I would be a terrible God. One of the reasons God's keeping me healthy and brought me through a heart attack, and I'm going to show you some pictures. I made a tape of me taking a bicycle ride tougher than any that I took before I had the heart attack. I'm going to give it to the doctor and say, now you look at this and take me off the medicine. I'm well. I haven't got much time to play God up here. The reason God's keeping me alive so long is because I'm a tough customer for God to break that out of my system. I always preach to myself, and I have here for 22 years. It's not easy to be created in God's image and not say, well, God, you were the boss for so long, take a rest and let me now. Why waste all this you've done on me? You created me in your image. Let me show it off. Sit down over there. Let me be the boss. That's the nice way to do it. Most of us aren't that nice. We just get the bit in our teeth and think that we are the boss. And that's why I said the tree was in the garden. God is not relinquishing his position on top of the heap. He created all the gifts, the musical skills in Satan, the son of the morning, the crowning cherub on the mountain of God. Gave him all that brought him, obviously, a large following in heaven, for a third of heaven's angels followed him. He looked at himself. Isaiah and Ezekiel show him in the garden before the earth became a waste and desolation. He looked in the mirror, decided, I'm really something. I shall ascend and be like God. No, we read that account and we think, what a fool. And promptly put the book down that tells us the story and start acting like Satan. I'm in charge of my life. Marred by the fall in every generation There are only a few that have a little beacon inside that this wreck of Adam kind, not mankind, this wreck of Adam kind that trusted Satan and didn't trust God and followed Satan rather than God, because Satan said, you can have what you want. And God's the ogre who doesn't want you to have it. And God says, you can have everything I tell you you can have, and you can't have what I tell you you can't have. Well, they followed Satan. And God said, I will not fail of my purposes, and in every generation, no man cometh to the Father save the Spirit draw him. The natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit, neither can he know them, for they're spiritually discerned. And in every generation, because as God has said, my purposes fail not, God, before the worlds were formed, knowing the predilection for failure in this creature, he had formed and put part of his nature in, the image of God, would be marred because having been given freedom without which you cannot trust or love, you can misuse it. Sin, in essence, is the misuse of freedom. All we like sheep have gone astray, turned everyone to our own way. What the church concentrates on as sin is but symptoms of a misdirected life. One that goes its way. And Satan is there to push, and the world is there to push. If you were of the world that seeks its own, the world would love you. But you're not of the world, because I've called you out, chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. You get on their track, they push. Satan, he wants company in hell. He pushes. And every generation, we're born into a situation with the deck stacked against God. And not everybody in every generation does God want. But knowing the potential for failure and the misuse of sin, or misuse of freedom, resulting in sin, God chose. Before he formed the world, before the recreation began in Genesis 1, 2 onward, before he formed Adam out of the dust and Eve from Adam, God, with Jesus as the speaking member of the Godhead, as the Ephesian letter declares, Hebrews declares Jesus was that speaking voice, Ephesians declares that famous word, ex electo, that he chose us, a done deed, before the worlds were formed, for himself, called out of all those he didn't choose. So in every generation, there are those that have an extra dimension, an implant, a residual element of God's image in us. I have explained parapsychology for years, extrasensory gifts can be divine spirit endowment, it can be demonic, supernatural forces working, or it can be simply a genetic throwback to the pre-fall Adamic state. I am totally convinced that when God created Adam and breathed into him Ruach and imparted his nature into this creature, and Adam became a living soul, Adam had qualities that would boggle our mind. And I'm totally convinced that recessive genes in odds that rival the Powerball lottery odds and beyond. Occasionally, these recessive genes that go back to Adam hit, and you have a throwback that has extrasensory natural abilities if Adam is defined as natural. Jesus is called supernatural. The word simply means more natural. He was the most natural. And he had the ability to see Nathanael under a tree before he got there. The Samaritan woman, he could tell her life story on the spot, first time meeting. You want to say, well, that's supernatural divine. Yes, but so was Adam. He was natural, and God breathed into him. Sin withdrew from the contact with the Spirit. Man began to die at that moment. And as time went on, lifespan shortened. And now, as we are gaining knowledge that God already has and that He implanted, they're now trying to get computers that will think as men think. Now, I mean, we're just approaching some of the borderline, like early penetration of space, borderline of the knowledge that is God's knowledge and the abilities that were natural to Adam but have denigrated in the death that resulted in sin and the separation from the source of life. But in this stream of life through generation after generation, in each generation, God, or Paul and Ephesians must be written out of the book. God shows, out of every generation, how He made it work. Maybe. I don't need to explain how He made it work, because I don't know. But in each generation, He put something inside those few that He chose out from among those He didn't choose, that I pictured here with the blue, the color of the divine spirit in this flesh and blood man. Those that have it can respond to God. Those that don't have it don't have the capacity to respond. They're natural men. The natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit. He can't even know them. Now, surely you've met a few people like this. They're as dead to spiritual things. They think you're nut to even talk about these things. I mean, spiritual things? There's only sex, cars, and sports to talk about. Money and how to make it with the least amount of effort and the fastest. Now, that's the subject of the natural man. Spiritual men have, like spinning through, some of you have shortwave sort of fluid type on a band. You don't have clicks or anything. You just sort of roll the wheel on your shortwave and you come across a voice. You come across another one. Now, turn your short wave off and try to hear that voice. Twist your ear or some other extremity. You may make an extremity hurt. Other cases make it feel good. But you ain't going to hear anything if you're not on the beam. Receiver, transmitter. Without a receiver, the transmission is still out there in the air. But without the receiver, you ain't picking it up. Now, I'm taught on this for years, declared it from God's Word for years. Probably never spent as much time on it before. But you've heard me lament. Do you have any idea how fortunate you are that you have a heart toward God? Haven't some of you married a block of stone spiritually? How many of you have had that experience? Let's just go ahead and confess.
You know, the evangelical church world has so deadened the truth on this that I sound like a person far out to teach this truth written all through Scripture. No man cometh to the Father save the Spirit call him. God doesn't want some. The parable of the sower, so he cloaks the truth in parable, lest some hear and understand and see and perceive. Pharaoh, on this earth for one reason, to demonstrate the adverse attitude toward God, that he might be used by God as a teaching tool to show what happens to those kinds. God chooses some, doesn't choose others. We don't have any trouble in the evangelical world accepting the fact God chose Abraham. And this group of descendants in this same book, Deuteronomy, that I'm trying to get to, he says, did I choose you because you were great? No. I chose you out of all the nations of the earth, and you were a nobody. You were a nothing. It reeks with an image like most people would be ashamed to be seen in your presence. And I chose you to show my grace for my purposes, not because you deserved it, but to shower my love on you. Out of all mankind, I picked you, the chosen people. We all accept that in the evangelical world. Yet we find it so hard in the modern world to accept the fact that God isn't available for anybody, everywhere. Whosoever will may come. Right? Whosoever will may come. But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit, so his willer is pointing the wrong direction. The only way your willer will point his direction is if God chose you and put the responsive mechanism in you to respond. You know how lucky you are. You could have been born in a part of the world covered with another religious or philosophic frame. That's for starters. And yet, in certain generations, those born in those frames, God finds a way to get the light to them. And lo and behold, same as here. Some have a responsive capacity, some don't. I remember my first trip overseas. I was pressured by some, advised by some. Now, you know, you've got to make it simple for them. And, you know, Americans have had this tendency for years to view other countries as somehow inferior children. Come from the old colonial days when the Oxford lectures that justified their colonial existence by saying that they were commissioned to bring these primitive societies up to their standards. I didn't even try it. I told you the story about preaching down in Buenos Aires. And I had a missionary from Canada who was translating. And I was handling subjects the same as I do with you, teaching on the tabernacle. And in the middle of my message, and you know, I was more traditionally Christian in those days. He would have taken a long sleep if it were Gene Scott of today. But, you know, in those days, I was almost Christian. right in the middle of my message, he just sat down and says, they can't understand this. This is too complicated for them. Just sit down. And it was a student audience at a Bible school in Buenos Aires. And the students began yelling, we do understand it. Continue. And a student came up and translated for me while the old sour goat sat over there and frowned. Because to this day I see the look on the face of the head of a very large church group in southern Brazil. Down near the Argentine border, Uruguay, out of the back country that brought ministers in for Ministers Institute. I still see the look on his face because I've not been able to honor the request as he grabbed my hand and said, Dr. Scott, if we had known we were going to get teaching like this, I would have had 1,000 of my ministers here. Please, please, will you come back again? And I said I would. I hope I live long enough to honor that request. But again, the point I'm making, language barriers, translations, God puts the capacity to respond. And this idea of winning souls that has covered the church world to where every person is a scalp to be hung on your belt. And every man, his blood may be at my hands if I don't warn him and save him if I've come across his path. And this knock him down for Jesus witnessing routine. And the oversimplification that every person on the face of this earth must once get a chance. And when we've carried out the Great Commission, we've finally taken the gospel to the whole world, then Jesus can come. Poor Bible students that can't figure out that God gave to the descendants of Abraham the order. They were chosen not just for privilege, but to be his oracle. Now, that blessing went to the sons of Joseph and the Celtic nations have carried forth that mission, being the gospel carriers of the world. But God, who never changes his purposes, will finish the job of evangelizing the world during the millennium when the church is already up and gone. And with the Feast of the Tabernacles, enforcing it with a plague if they don't come, they will come to Jerusalem, and the Jews, finally recognizing him whom they pierced, will teach the message of the tabernacle themselves and the gospel story to the world. They'll finish evangelizing the world. Jesus will come before it's done. And will finish the job during the millennium. God knows who his subjects are. He chose them before the worlds were formed. And the purpose of today's message is to make us understand how fortunate we are to have, even with a little static, the capacity to hear his voice. What do you think Jesus means when he says, my sheep know my voice? There are some of you that left the established church. There are some of you that by the church world's traditional standards would say that you are anti-God and away from God and have never been close to God. But you know something in you which, as you look back, makes you recognize that God was moving in your life when you didn't even know it. Something in you won't let you release what Tozer calls this pursuit of God. There's something in you that hungers for a food that the natural things cannot supply. That is the indication you are one of the most fortunate people of the generation hearing my voice, because you're one of God's called. Oh, I've watched over the 22 years. I've watched people come to the church for various reasons. natural reasons. And they fall out along the way. Then I've seen others. Man, some have been an irritation to me beyond belief. If I were God, they'd be dead. But I'll give them this. There's just something that compels them to come and hear the truth. I've watched them. In fact, there have been a few. I'm not dumb. They may not like Gene Scott, and that's their problem. I mean, I'm the most likable guy in the world. I can't figure people out who don't like me. How? But I can tell. Some of them can't stand me. But they run off somewhere else and find some lily-handed, always smiling, sweet-talking little fruitcake of a preacher, and they listen to what comes out of the mouth. Now, the mouth may be good for other things, but it doesn't give God's Word very good. Some of them can eat up a storm. The fat-friendly preachers. And then there are what I call congregation-friendly preachers. You can figure that one out. Some friendly with the men. Some friendly with the women. I ain't going any further. And they don't like Scott. I mean, you know. And there's some that have gotten close enough to have their flesh carved up a little. So they like to sit in the darkened area of the auditorium where I can't see they're there. But you can't drive them away with a stick. I'll give them this. They know the truth when they hear it. They may not like the mouthpiece, but they know the truth. And if they stay around long enough, the truth will show them they should like the mouthpiece. But I'm being realistic today. I really do know, to their sad state, that everybody doesn't love me. They should. But they don't. What I'm looking for, and if there's one thing that makes me different from any other preacher, unless it's one like me, is I would rather have you love the Word than love me. Is a gift from God so rare. You want to add it up? Figure those who come here with the 14, 15 million in Los Angeles that have this opportunity and have no interest in it. That's the ratio. And this is the country God chose from which to send the light, the beam out, where those in every area of the world with this receiver built in by God before the worlds were formed can say, that's it. That's what I've been waiting to hear. We get it in the messages. I have pastors in Liberia, Christians already established around the world just like you, but waiting to have a voice of truth without compromise that is the pure, unadulterated message from Christ through Paul, grace, faith, peace with God. And this message from God doesn't go different directions. There's only one message from God, and it's on a beam that this implant receives. If you haven't got it, they're going to receive it. All these other voices from the world, from the devil, false prophets, they can penetrate. This message from God only received by those that have that spirit quality retained by God to receive. You know how lucky you are? I ain't close to my message for the day. I am going to probably spend 2 more weeks at least in Deuteronomy 28 on the message that I started last Sunday, 2 Sundays ago in fact, didn't get to it, which begins with the statement, because thou servest not the Lord thy God with joyfulness and with gladness of heart. What's that mean? Joyfulness and gladness of heart. That doesn't necessarily mean happy surroundings. For the abundance of all things, therefore shalt thou serve thine enemies, which the Lord shall send against thee, and hunger and thirst, and want of all things. The message that I said I'd get to, and I will next Sunday, begins with, the word is slave. But it's slave in the sense of worship. It is slavery that follows after an intrinsic thing of value. You are tuned in and want something because you see its value. You're either going to serve God, the value of which is so hit you finally, starting with the realization of how precious it is to be one of those that God has called. You will serve God with joyfulness and gladness of heart. And that's an interesting line I want to get to in prosperity, which we all want and the devil says we can get some other way. Or you will serve your enemies. Your enemies is the flesh, the world, and the devil. But there's an interesting line there. To those that turn from God's call, the rest of the world, they just are captives to the world, the flesh, and the devil, and they don't have any little receiver inside. That's the rest of the world. Those that He planted the receiver in and has called you, and the signal has found you somewhere mysteriously, openly, in whatever way, God found you. To having seen and tasted, to turn from that call, the Bible compares you to a dog returning to his vomit, and a pig to his wallow. You're worse. I've told you, and this is the message, how wonderful to be one of the called. But you are worse off than those that were never called if you renege in your response. And this is where I'm going to end the message, which sends you out of here, I hope, thinking. Better never have been called. That's what the Bible says. Better never to have been called than to receive the call and taste and turn back. There remaineth no more remission for those people's sins. These other people, they're just slaves. They don't know it. They're happily serving self while these puppet masters pull the strings on our self-service. And they're just happy. They're not disturbed. You are the disturbed ones, who are the fortunate ones that have the capacity to respond. And you have started the way, but like the sister of Ruth and Boaz,
another part of the message that I intend to finish. You go back. You don't just go back to the state of serving your enemies. God compounds it because it says, therefore shalt thou be slave to thine enemies, which the Lord shall send against thee. All of a sudden, now God's in partnership with the flesh, the world, and the devil, horrid as it sounds, to totally destroy you. This is the truth that's been abused and applied only to homosexuals by the fundamentalists in the book of Romans. Those that know the Creator, but instead of worshiping, which is giving yourself in total commitment to the Creator, knowing better, instead worship the creature. Well, that's not limited to homosexuality. I don't care what the fundamentalists say. It's every one of you that lives your life preserving self when God's message is, he that saveth his life shall lose it. But he that loseth his life for my sake and the gospel shall gain it unto life eternal. And you that are worshiping the creature, which is yourself, more than God, who paradoxically offers life to the dying self. God says in Romans, those that do that, he will turn over to a strong delusion, and they'll believe a lie and be damned. God, as the devil and the world appear to be on your side as they push you into your self-preservation ways, and the flesh sure applauds your self-preserving ways, now God gets on the team. Having given you what so few in this world have, the capacity to respond to his call, and you betrayed him in a throwback to Adam and Eve, he turns on you. And he sends the enemies to bring you to the last line, destruction. So the first part of this message is, you got a choice, and the only choice you got, you're going to be slave to God or slave to your enemies. Plural. That's your choice. You walk out of here today. You have 6 days between now and next Sunday. You're going to serve self, the world, and the devil, or you're going to serve God and his claim on you. I don't have to preach and try to convert people. I don't make all the calls. The commitment and the understanding happens as I preach. If you have the receiver inside, decisions are made right this very instant as you sit there. In many cases, they're renewed decisions. That's the way we progress and learn as we go along what pleases the Lord. But you better start somewhere in this journey figuring out who the enemy is. Because you are going to be mastered by the enemy, or you're going to be mastered by God. And there is no in between. You're either going this way or you're going that way. And that's your choice, slave of God or slave of the enemies. But it's more than that. God, too, becomes your enemy when you reject him. I, as sobering as it is, leave my message there. Hopefully God will let me pick it up next Sunday with the next point in this verse. You're going to serve in honor or serve in degradation. That's my message for today.
offering time. You may say, God's tough. You're damn right he is. But he's awfully good to those that put him first. He gave his son gave his life. He wants to bless you and show you off in eternity, ruling and reigning with him throughout eternity. The devil caters to you, but wants company while he fries. The harsh reality is, you aren't God. You are created by God for his purpose. Most of this creation he's already written off. You lucky ones, he put the response capacity in. I wish I could say, in street terms, what this message is saying. You know, don't bleep in your mess kit. You got it? Just think, I could have said this hour and 10 minute message in one sentence. I'm glad you got it. The song says it. I'm going to have them sing it again. I'd rather have Jesus than anything. And the paradox is, I hate to say this because then people are motivated the wrong way. The paradox is, when this song is true in your life, all the things that you say you'd give up for Jesus, he has the capacity to give back to you in a loving relationship. That's the paradox that foolish Christianity can't seem to absorb. I hope you got it today. You said you did. Now the offering, I'll be looking at you sometime this week. I intend to go live this afternoon. So I won't be right at 2, but try to get out of here, Voices of Faith and crew, so I can go live this afternoon on festival. I'll be rushing out of here myself shortly. So buy out the taco stand or go without and fast. Give me company on festival, live this afternoon. Song, I'd Rather Have Jesus. Good day, folks.